Fasten your seatbelts and turn up your radio. We're going on a road trip. In just a matter of weeks, thousands of children in north central Wisconsin will start a new school year. What that will look like has become a thorny issue, both politically and epidemiologically. But for school officials, the question is how to resume K through 12 education while limiting the risks to children, their teachers, school staffers, and communities. Welcome to Route 51. I'm Shereen Siewert. This is a pivotal moment in the coronavirus pandemic. As the number of infections statewide and regionally continue to rise, and scientists are still working to understand just how the virus affects children and how children affect the spread of the virus. There is no proven strategy. There's no formula for reopening schools amid a pandemic like this one, and much of the scientific understanding of how the coronavirus affects children is provisional. But school officials have spent months developing strategies to reopen safely, while keeping a sharp eye on research, infection trends, and recommendations from public health officials. Joining us today from the D.C. Everest School District is Superintendent Christine Gilmore, who oversees schools serving Weston, Schofield, Hatley, Rothschild, Cronenwetter, Ringle, and Easton in central Wisconsin. Christine, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Also joining us today from the Shawamigan School District, Administrator Mark Wettig, to discuss what's happening in Park Falls and Glidden schools. Mark, welcome to Route 51.
Great to be here.
Because this program has been pre-recorded, we are unable to take your calls this week. But I am so pleased that you're both here, in part because you represent very different school districts. I know, though, despite the differences, you're grappling with the same central issue, how to ensure the children in your district are going to get the education they deserve this year while keeping everyone safe at the same time. So, Mark, how many students and how many schools are in the Shawamigan district?
We've got 775 students. And five schools, actually, on two campuses. Shawamigan is the consolidation of the former Park Falls and Glidden school districts. So it actually is the largest geographical school district in the state at 742 square miles. So we've got a middle school and an elementary school in Glidden to the north. And then we've got the high school and another elementary school down in Park Falls to the south, along with a charter school. In between us is the district of Butternut, which we travel through several times a day.
Okay. All right. Christine, what about Everest? I know it's a smaller geographical area. How many students, how many schools are we talking about in DC Everest District?
So we have 6,000 plus students, and we have 11 schools. So six elementaries, a middle school, junior high school, charter, multi-age school. So we're not quite as large geographically, but we do serve 12 municipalities.
Okay. And I guess realizing that this whole coronavirus pandemic situation is still very fluid, I'd really like to hear from each of you what your current plan is, what your current thoughts are about what it will look like for the upcoming semester. And I realize that there's a lot that could change. Mark, right now, in a general sense anyway, what do you think it's going to look like in Park Falls and Glidden?
Well, we've put together three plans, which kind of parallel the state plan for in-person, which would be everybody's back in the school, similar with safety precautions, similar to if there was a heavy flu outbreak. The blended situation where we would have half or three quarters of the students back, and then the virtual situation where everybody, the schools are closed like they were in the spring. If I were to say today what we're going to do, I would say we would open in person with everybody back. I meet with local health officials every 2 weeks, and we will continue to do that throughout the year and make decisions to change or pivot from one of those spots every 2 weeks. We'll meet in the second week of August and make the decision on how school will actually start.
Okay. And Christine, obviously, Governor Tony Evers had said that not all school districts are going to look the same. I mean, some of it will depend on the numbers in their region. So what is DC Everest considering right now?
So actually tonight is our board meeting for our board to approve our Future Ready Restart plan. And just like you said, this is all going to be very fluid and dependent on what happens with the virus. But it also is dependent on how nimble we can be as a district. And I think that's going to be really important. Our plan started by us surveying what our parents want, our families want, and where what our staff feels. So our plan looks like a return to school option for families 5 days a week, really focused on K-7 being every day. And then the 8-12 being every day, but potential with some blended. We have a lot of courses, for example, some of our AP courses where students might come in for the lab, but be able to do some of the online lectures so we can reduce numbers. All of that, of course, with PPE and new procedures and processes. We also are providing a virtual option that is 100% virtual for a semester or a year for our families, K-12. About 10% of our parents wanted that. And then, of course, for that face-to-face at any time could go back into that remote learning or virtual kind of blended learning. And I really think what's different this time than was this spring, you know, we closed as an entire state. I really think this starts this time. First, it's student by student. It could be by class as we look at cohort models. It could be a school, and then it could be a district. So it won't be if one of our schools is 20 miles away from another. If one has an outbreak, that doesn't mean the other will close. So it's really that keeping up to date with the data, talking to our families, talking to our staff, and then making decisions in the best that we can for our families.
Well, you know, you talked about surveying parents. Mark, what did you do in Shawmagon to survey parents and to get their feedback? What kind of feedback are you getting?
We wanted to find out what went well and what didn't go well from the parents and from the staff. And the feedback was that little ones being at home didn't work well for a lot of different reasons. Trying to do an unlimited amount of hours during the day where they could have access to staff really was hard on the staff. That was another thing that we found out. We had staff members that were getting emailed at 9:10 at night, and they were trying to keep up with that. So one change that comes from that this fall will be that for students that are doing this virtually, they'll have office hours when they can contact staff, because I think we're going to be in this for the long run. You know, we kind of on the 13th found out that things were shutting down last spring, so we put things together, and then by the following Wednesday we were doing things virtually as best we could. But those are two of the things that we learned that would really be important, is that staff time that they're working has to be set, and the students need to be on a schedule with a pacing plan at home for how much work they need to do. Some students jumped in and did everything that they were asked to do in a day, and other ones lagged on till the end and finished. So a pacing plan's what we found out from families would be very important as well.
Christine, what are you hearing from teachers? It sounds like there was a whole lot of feedback in Shawmagon.
Yeah, so we did the same kind of survey of our families from what happened this spring, and I think the biggest piece is we were lucky that we have been one-to-one for many years and have had a lot of professional development. But really what I think shines in that kind of environment is inequalities. And we really think about equity a lot in our work. So we had students who are English language learners. We have a large population in our district. And imagine how difficult that transition is if your parents don't speak English or read English, and now suddenly you're virtual and you're dependent on your kindergartner or first grader. And so we had, you know, translated hotlines. And we also know that it became really complicated for staff because, you know, some of our families, although they had excellent access to technology, but their kids needed guidance, but the parents might have been working from home, or we had parents who were essential workers. I did hear from one of our families where both worked in at a local hospital and had six kids at home. And, you know, it was a real struggle for them to come home in that night, try to make up for what happened in the day, because obviously daycare was a true issue. So our staff, just like our community, has different feelings across the board. And I think that's what makes this the most complicated, is that it unfortunately has become polarized. There are no right answers at any moment. And so we're really trying to meet people where they're at and understand that and provide people with options.
I know the CDC, in the guidelines that were issued recently, they were really pushing schools to have backup staffing plans in place if teachers say that they can't or they won't come back to class. Do you have a sense that there will be some teachers who fit into that category that just cannot come back to work, or they don't feel comfortable going back to work, Christine?
So we surveyed staff with that because obviously some have medical issues, et cetera, and then we'll work around those. Because we are opening that pure virtual school, we will provide that as an opportunity for some of our staff. And this is, we hope, a limited time. I find it interesting that the CDC gives that instruction that we should just go find additional staff. Because one, we've been talking about a teacher shortage now for quite some time. And two, what do we do about costs for that? Most people would expect some type of paycheck, right?
Mm-hmm,
and
sure.
So as we try to balance all of this, what sounds like a good idea on a piece of paper just might not be realistic. So when I talked about that flexibility and adaptability, we've talked to our staff as, you know, we are assuring everybody's going to have their job. And if you're hired as a teacher, you just might not have the same looking job as you've had in the past. The expectations might be different. We might need people to step up out and if they have different licensure. You might be doing something supporting virtually. This is going to take all of us doing everything we can to make sure kids have successful learning experiences. And it's not going to be based on what we normally do.
Mark, what about in your district? What are you hearing from teachers? Do you have a sense that there may be some who feel the same way, that they just cannot, they for health reasons or for other reasons, they just will not come back to the classroom?
We're doing a survey this next week that'll give us some more definite answers with that. And I'm meeting with the president of the union tomorrow, and I know that that's going to be a topic that will come up. I know that nationwide, 25% of teachers have some kind of condition that would compromise them. Right now, I'm not finding out from teachers that there are any of them that would say that they can't come back at this point. But we need to have those conversations, find out the facts, and then I need to talk to, actually our conference is scheduled a legal discussion within the next week to find out what we can do from an HR standpoint as well. We started working on reentry in May, and one thing that we did right away is put together classroom live teaching packages. So here we'll be able to teach live from every classroom with all the cameras and all the equipment that is necessary. So if we were to go to the virtual model, we will be able to teach live from a classroom. If we're in a blended model, we can teach where there's some students that are in the classroom and some students that are at home. And we're also a one-to-one district, so every student will have a device. And then we'll also teach live, even if we're in person, for students that are vulnerable or can't be in the classroom, they'll be able to attend from home. So that gives us some flexibility in terms of how we work with our teachers. So that'll be a luxury for us. We'll be able to teach live all year long.
You're listening to Shawamigan School Administrator Mark Wettig and D.C. Everest School Superintendent Christine Gilmore on Route 51 discussing strategies to safely reopen schools in the fall amid the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. When we return, we'll discuss how schools can best address the needs of students with special needs and what the future could hold for extracurricular activities like drama, music, and sports programs. I'm Shereen Siewert. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Siewert, D.C. Everest School Superintendent Christine Gilmore, and Shawamigan School Administrator Mark Wettig are here today on Route 51, discussing their ideas for safely reopening schools in their districts this fall. Christine, the shift to virtual learning in March really stoked fears among parents of students with special needs, thinking that their children might not get the education they needed, the other services like speech therapy and counseling that they were entitled to under federal law, of course, while schools were shut down. What did your district do to ensure that that didn't happen?
So I think that really starts with strong communication. We spent a lot of time checking in with families, really making sure we could provide everything possible for our students. But I'm going to tell you that in some instances, you know, physical therapy is very hard to do virtually if a parent can't assist. But I do think we were surprised to learn in many instances it worked out better than we thought. I happen to have a husband who's a teacher of the visually impaired, and I could see firsthand him working online with his students, holding sessions every day live with them, working with their families. And but there are instances, for example, he teaches orientation mobility, which is cane travel, that he will be meeting with those families later this summer and those students individually, because it's impossible to teach cane travel virtually, right? You have to practice. So I think really it boils down, students with special needs are on IEPs, and so it gets to that individualized discussion of what did we, what were we able to provide and what were we not able to? And now really around compensatory services, what are we going to provide to make up for that time? It isn't simple. We also surveyed all of our parents just again recently, especially of our students that might be more medically fragile or compromised, to see how comfortable parents were, what they were comfortable with, and then really trying to build our plans around what parents wanted for their children.
Now, Mark, you talked about the live classrooms that are available in your district, and one of the things that parents have been talking about is the lack of technology and broadband in some of the rural areas of the state. We've heard about parents who had to drive their students to a parking lot of a public library just to do their work. Are you hearing any concerns from parents or teachers in your district about broadband disparities?
Yes, definitely. With 742 square miles, and much of it is the Shawamigan-Nicolet National Forest, we've got students that are out in the middle of nowhere, and they don't have the ability to access the internet. And we have a plan with folks. For folks, we're working with companies here, and we're buying hotspots. If people have weak internet, we will work with them so that it's strong enough to, so that they can use the school services from home. But we've got that group that there's no way that they're going to ever connect based on where they live. So the plan with that is that if we're in a blended situation where we have half the students back, we'll need to transport students with no internet to the school. And then we can use some of our large spaces where they can work with supervision just as if they were at home as their fellow students are. If we're in a virtual if we're in the virtual situation where there's no students in the schools, we're working out agreements with the local library here in Park Falls and some of the town buildings in the northern region where we would transport students there and provide a paraprofessional for supervision, and then they could work in those areas. And then we have to work now to make sure that their ability to connect to the internet from those sites is strong enough. So one thing we're going to do is, in the town of Jacobs, way up north, is to we'll transport the students there in a bus. with a hotspot on it that will connect. And then while they're in the town of Jacobstown Hall, they'll be able to connect while they're in there. So that's some of the things we've got set up. I guess I have to say this. It's like electrification. Holy cow, I messed that word up. 100 years ago, where the big push was to get electricity to everyone, this, I hope, stimulates us to get broadband to everyone because we see how important that is.
It certainly pulled back the curtain on some disparities here. Do you think that there is some action that could maybe take place at the state level that would help this? It sounds like you're really thinking outside the box and trying to come up with some unique solutions. But do you see a long-term fix down the road?
I see us working on it. I know I'm working with our state senator and representative right now to make that push within the state for electrification. There, I did it.
You did it. Yeah, it's certainly been a topic of discussion for some time now. You know, some parents are really great at helping students learn at home. Some are not. For others, it's difficult. And part of that is the broadband issue. So, I mean, Chris, what are your thoughts on the broadband issue?
So it's a real issue here, even in Marathon County. I think people would say, oh, DCF for 6,000 students, not a problem. We help families get hotspots, and that's easy. That's the easy work. The parts of that are difficult is just a couple miles down from our middle school is we have families who buy two cell services and internet and still cannot download anything. So people say buy them a hotspot. Well, it has to connect to something, right? So we're actually working and looking at the feasibility of us as a district putting up a tower out in one of our rural areas. And I'm trying to get local businesses to partner because I really believe this broadband issue is bigger than schools. It's about people moving here for small business. It's about access to information. If you want to look at your hospital or medical things, it's all online now. So I think it is a real issue that this has really pulled back the curtain on. And I think schools are looking outside to figure these things out, but it's bigger than schools.
I'm curious if either of you see any opportunities where school districts could perhaps share services if you have to go back to a virtual education. Mark, what are your thoughts?
District sharing services in terms of what?
I mean, do you think that perhaps districts could share services? You talked about, you know, busing students to areas where there are large spaces and they could, I mean, is that something that you could partner with other schools to help more students?
I think we could do that. Sure. We would be very welcoming to sharing those kind of services. The students that are on the fringe, the borders of our district, would be able to share with other districts. We're in four counties with, I think we border seven districts, so that definitely is something to look into. Chris, I was going to say I love the idea of looking to work with businesses to build a tower, and thank you for that idea. I'm going to jot a note about that.
I really want to ask you both about the current status on extracurricular activities, like sports, not just sports, but what about things like band and choir and drama productions? Chris, what are the plans at DC Everest for those kinds of activities?
So we don't really have the answers. I know people want us to, but we're really waiting for guidance on what WIA is going to say about sports. As of July 1, we did reopen our facilities to what would be like our summer programs. DC Everest has a long history of community education. We actually own a facility called the Green Heck Fieldhouse that has an indoor ice arena, three courts, a very large fitness center like a YMCA, which had typically been used by the community. And so for now, we've started on a very small scale, only providing those activities around our students, trying to get those back. And we're really trying to think differently. So this spring, we were scheduled to have a musical, and our kids had already started. Our director was really forward-thinking and created three different musicals that kids did their own recording. They all have devices to record on, and it was built virtually. And so we did have a musical, just wasn't the traditional musical people think of. So I think it's going to be in flex. We're all watching and waiting. So right now our students are working out in small groups of 10. We have them scheduled throughout the day. But I did talk to one of our coaches the other day, and he said, you know, I don't want to leave this model next year. I would love to stay with it. It's forced us to really be with kids. Younger kids are less leery. It's really helped us, I think, focus on those relationships. And so I think there's a lot to learn during this time that we can take away to make whatever we do better in the future.
Well, that was one thing I really wanted to touch on. I mean, this has been a seismic shift, not just for schools, but for businesses. I mean, and we're working from home. We're doing things in a different way. There are lessons that we perhaps have learned. Mark, what are some of the lessons that you look back on and think, okay, we're doing this in a way that works now. We won't go back.
Well, I know one shining moment this spring was there was a couple of students that did not perform well here, but virtually this spring, they excelled, and they just jumped off the charts in terms of performance. So giving that option to students in the future is going to be something that we'll look at as well. This past spring, I was very proud of what we did, but it wasn't good enough. It wasn't fantastic, and I really want to make it fantastic this next year through teaching live to all students. Another aspect of this is teachers can teach live and record what they're doing, and if students are home for an extended period or even just the day, they can connect or they can catch it when it's recorded later on. That's going to be something that's important, and it's going to affect how we use our substitute teachers as well. When we have snow days and that kind of thing now, we won't need to close schools. We'll literally be able to keep them open from a live standpoint. So there's going to be a lot of things that are going to come from this that are going to change what we do.
One of the risks of keeping schools closed for a prolonged stretch is that more kids go hungry. Mark, I know that you had a program to help hungry kids when your school shut down in March, and there were similar programs in other districts. Christine, what's the best way to ensure children have enough food when their healthiest meal of the day might be in the school setting?
So for us, it actually grew not only from students, but to families. So we, like many other schools, provided breakfast and lunch during this time at pickup sites and did deliveries. But because all of the food pantries out in my area closed because they were mostly in local churches, as a district, we also fed adults every day and did a fundraising campaign simply by putting out a call I did on Facebook. We received over $60,000 in donations in a few days. And so since March 13th through the summer, every day of the week, we are providing breakfast and lunches to any adult and any student in need, plus sending home groceries through our Blessings in a Backpack on Fridays. We have to have a plan for this to continue. I truly believe for some of our students that school is about the missed learning, but it's about people first, right? How do you learn if you don't have enough to eat? How do you learn if somebody doesn't care and love you? And not that families don't love their kids, but kids know those things. And this has been a really difficult time. So a lot of the things we talk about are really about the social emotional learning pieces of this. I think Mark talked about being so proud of their staff. With 6,000 kids within a week, we did personal contacts with every kid and family. And I think that was more important than any lesson that we put up on the computer, right? People need people. And so I think whether it be food, clothing, transportation, we provided gas assistance for kids to go to mental health therapy sessions because we didn't want to see those stop. I think those are all important pieces of our community, and schools are a big portion of the community.
Well, I know, too, that more cases of child neglect go undetected when schools aren't open. We know this from social workers, from police. They tell us that this is the case. So, Mark, what about you? Have you given some thought to how you'll manage that scenario if schools go virtual? How you identify those cases where kids might not be getting the care they need at home?
Well, Christine was exactly right that feeding children and having those relationships, those are the most important things that we do. We found out that two things had to happen. One is that our counseling and our mental health people had to do everything they could to make contact with students. And if that meant virtual contact where it was a chat, a video chat with them, that was very helpful. Every week we had our principal and counselors going out to folks' houses to meet with them, and, you know, students that kind of got lost where we didn't hear from them for a while, the teachers had to communicate with counselors and the principals that, hey, there's somebody out there, we haven't talked to them in a while, and then they had to make contact with them. So we had them driving out and talking to them if they couldn't contact some other way. But I have to be honest with you, there's a new term out there called ghosting where folks can avoid contact unless you drive out to their house and knock on the door. They don't have to answer an email or their phone or a request for a video conference. That's a hurdle we're going to have to face if we have some long-term virtual learning going on this year.
Sure, and how do you handle that? I mean, how do you handle non-compliance? We were talking off-air about students that just, they never heard from them again after the shutdown happened. I mean, how do you deal with that if students or parents purposely ghost you? I mean, Christine, what do you do at DC Everest?
So it's just like Mark. We, our social workers, our guidance staff, our assistant principals, we are doing home visits. We have a group of families that we check on every week. I do think, though, it's complicated, especially this spring. I'll be the first. My husband's an educator. I'm an educator. We had a senior student who he did really well in the classes he chose, and a couple he felt like this was hoop jumping, and I think it was the one thing he felt he had control over, right? Because he'd lost his end of his senior year, all that was important to him. So I think as a society and as schools, we have to take that into consideration that sometimes kids are making decisions and that we have to understand their whole story before we start making judgments about that. Because I think for all of us, this is my 18th year as superintendent at DC Everest. And I can tell you, I've gone through lots of different things. I have never lost more sleep over worrying about our kids are okay, are our staff okay? How are we going to pull this off? How can we do this to make it as safe as possible? Because you know we can't mitigate every risk. Can we do what families need us and want us to do and then change on a dime if we have to, because we're a fairly large organization? And I think we have to just consider where people are at and then try to meet them there.
Mark, what are your thoughts on this? How do you handle the ghosting?
Well, there's, I guess there's the two sides of this. Is one is, again, doing everything you can to contact them, including going out and knocking on the door or talking to other contacts that we're small enough that we would know other students or families that we could work with, just to say, could you please make contact with someone? We're looking for them. Is there any way we can get in touch with them? The other part of this, and Christine mentioned communication before for a different reason, but I think that's going to be so important between now and the beginning of school, is communicating that when school starts up in the fall, it's not going to be like it was in the spring, where some folks looked at it as an extended summer break. We're going to be taking attendance. We're going to have scheduled classes. We're going to have high expectations, and we will use our truancy as a hammer when we need it, just like we would when students are here, to bring them in. So there's that, the social side of it, of making the contacts and forming the relationships, and there's also setting the expectations that are going to be high so that folks know that going in, and hopefully that will alleviate a lot of those problems with some students that just might check out.
You're listening to DC Everest School Superintendent Christine Gilmore and Shawamagon School Administrator Mark Wettig on Route 51, discussing strategies to safely reopen schools in the fall amid the ongoing coronavirus pandemic. When we return, we'll discuss specific CDC recommendations for schools and how districts will serve students who do not feel they can safely return to the classroom this fall. I'm Shereen Seewert. This is Route 51 on Wisconsin Public Radio. We're back on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seewert. DC Everest School Superintendent Christine Gilmore and Shawamagon School Administrator Mark Wettig are here today on Route 51 discussing their ideas for safely reopening schools this fall. Because this week's program has been pre-recorded, we are unable to take your calls today. I have to wonder, what's your drop-dead decision date? I mean, it can't be August 31st. And it can't be tomorrow. So when do you reach the point of no return that you have to have a firm decision and you need it now? Mark, what about you and Shawamagon?
August 14th. I may have mentioned that every 2 weeks I'm meeting with local health officials and deciding what the risk level is within Price County. And then I'll do that for the year and we'll make a decision on how we'll proceed forward for the next 2 weeks at a time. And so August 14th is 2 weeks before the school year starts. So I've put the word out that I'd make the decision by then.
Christine, I know that you have a meeting coming up, but when do you expect that final decision to be made?
So if the board approves this restart plan tonight, it really gives the authority to me to make those decisions with our team of administrators, staff to move forward. And I do think it's going to be day by day. I think we could have the best laid plan and August 30th, one of the schools can't open because 50% of the people have to be quarantined or something to that point. So with that, I mean, if you remember the spring, I mean, I think you looked at, what was it, the Sweet 16 basketball, the basketball tournament immediately had to shut down. I do think we're in that kind of situation, but I think our plan at this point is to provide people with options, and that is one, the in-person option that can blend, or two, it's that virtual, straight up virtual.
So the CDC has outlined steps that schools can take to minimize the risk for students. There's a list of them. One recommendation is that all students, teachers, and staff wear masks. Do you anticipate that masks will be a requirement in Park Falls and Glidden?
The CDC also recommended bus transportation numbers where we would put 11 students on a bus. It would take us all day to get the students here if we did that.
Sure.
I guess the point I'm making is we're working with local health to come up with some practical answers to some of those situations. So we've decided that if students are required to wear masks on buses, we can fit 44 students on a bus and we'll be able to transport that way. We will not require masks for our blended situation will be that we're going to bring back pre-K through 5 students in the district and then 6 through 12 students will be virtual. For a couple of reasons. One is that those are the students that suffer the most by not being here, and also their parents can then work. 6 through 12 students can be at home. We won't require the pre-K through 5 students to wear masks while they're in the classroom. I just don't think that's practical, and I don't think that it's it would work in those situations. If they move to another situation, for instance, if they go to the cafeteria and bring their lunch back to the classroom, they would have masks on in those situations. And then, of course, students would be able to wear masks if they wanted to. And if a student was showing some symptoms that weren't necessarily meeting the COVID stay-at-home requirements, we would ask them to wear a mask. But district-wide, I guess they won't be required to wear a mask unless they're moving, might be the way to summarize it.
Do you expect parent buy-in with that? Do you think there will be any pushback since masks have become such a polarizing issue, really, Mark?
yes, there will be pushback on that. But to be honest with you, I think there's, no matter what decisions we make, there's going to be pushback from some folks. And again, the communication between now and when school starts is going to be very important. So there isn't a surprise factor for folks. We're planning on doing films of folks play acting, what it would be like in the classrooms and walking through the halls and getting on the buses and entering the buildings, and then getting those out to parents as much as we can between now and the beginning of school, so people will understand where we're going and what it's going to be like. The communication factor, I think, is going to be big, with parents feeling safe to send their students back to school and understanding what it's going to be like when they're here.
Christine, what about masks in the D.C. Everest District? Do you have a plan for that?
So the plan going to the board tonight is really the hierarchy overview of our future ready restart. Those details, whether that be anything from physical spaces, daily protocols, we're still working through that with our local health department. But I do believe masks, like you said, have become a really polarizing issue. When we talk about masks at Everest, I'm currently working with the superintendent of WASA, our local chamber of commerce, some of our businesses, our county, to come out with a statement that really the reason we need and want people to wear masks is if you want schools to stay open and you want businesses to stay open, please play your part in wearing a mask when you cannot social distance more than 6 feet. I do believe that there are instances, kindergarten, first grade, we have done a lot of looked at a lot of the literature around, especially that from the American Academy of Pediatricians, that really says there are other things you should do, like cohort your students, meaning putting them in small groups and keeping them only with that group of students, is a much better bang for your buck kind of thing than masks are at a kindergarten age. So we're looking at all those, but I think we're lending very heavily towards masks, especially in the upper grade. I'm also working with our coaches to buy really cool, if I could say that, cool, Everest masks for our athletes, because we want to change the dialogue about it, right?
Okay.
So it's not political. It's really about the conversation of, we want to provide school for kids and opportunities for kids, and this is one avenue to help us get there.
You said that you're reaching out to the chamber and to businesses just mm-hmm. this week. Walmart and Sam's Club will require masks of shoppers. Best Buy announced last week they will require masks of all shoppers. Starbucks, I mean, the list is growing as the days go on, and more municipalities are requiring mask usage too. Ashland and Bayfield County, taking a look at that, for example. But there's still a lot of, as we discussed, a lot of polarization here. So what kind of buy-in are you seeing, Christine, when you're talking to the chamber and to other businesses?
So right now we're getting, I think, positive buy-in, because we're not saying this is about, I'll just put it out there, this is not a Democratic or a Republican issue. We're talking about D.C. Everest and WASA school districts being able to open and your local store, hopefully, to stay open, right? And we know this is one of the tactics we can use. So we're trying to give people, each person, I think, to keep our schools open, to keep our businesses open, each one of us plays a role, whether that's by choosing to stay home, to wear a mask. And if we refuse to wear, or for whatever reason don't want to wear a mask, then we maybe don't put ourselves in situations when we with close groups of people. I think we all can play a role in that. And so we're trying to talk about that individual role. Do I think that I probably won't get a call after this radio show? Probably. But I've been hired at D.C. Everest to do what I think is very best for the kids in our community. And that's what I'm talking about.
You know, Mark, you managed, you mentioned the younger children and perhaps not masking younger children. I know managing younger children who can't comprehend the risks involved, that has to be an exceptional challenge for administrators and for teachers. So what can you do to keep those students at a safe distance from one another?
Well, in our blended situation, we're going to put more students in more classrooms with supervision. So, for instance, if we had, three sections of a second grade class, we'll have four sections so we can keep them to a 12-to-1 ratio, which is what we worked out with our health department. And being able to teach live, so that'll be the social spacing within the classrooms. And the kids are going to really have to practice with their teachers and with the paras on how to social distance. We'll have signs, we'll have that kind of thing. But just like, you know, the first couple of weeks of school with the little ones, they're practicing how to get up out of their desk, how to walk in line to get somewhere, how to stand in line to get a drink from the water fountain, how to raise their hand. We're going to have to really emphasize social distancing. We'll have students in the classes, like Christine mentioned, the small cohort group, and the teachers will move between the classes rather than the students moving around. That'll be a big part of what we do. So really developing those habits will be tremendously important. That's why I think it's so important that we start out in person with all the students here so we can teach those habits with the students. We can get the older ones to understand what the strange schedule is going to be like when we go to blended learning. We can teach the younger ones how to use the devices if they end up being home with those devices. So a lot of modeling and learning when we start is going to be tremendously important.
We talked a little bit earlier about some of the lessons that you learned from the shutdown and shifting to a virtual model in the final months of the school year last semester. We talked about some of the successes, but what would you do differently if you had to do it all over again? Christine, what do you think?
I think, like Mark said earlier, it would have set a little bit tighter boundaries on expectations. We created those as we went. Our teachers did have, like, office hours, checking in on. I think what happened was there was too much left for chance, right? But in all reality, I'm pretty proud of an organization of 6,000 students can flip in about 2 days to a virtual opportunity. I do think as we move forward, we really took a stance on grading that we wouldn't do harm to kids because it was a very new and unique situation. However, we will be returning back towards more of our normal grading piece because some kids took advantage of that, which kids are smart, right?
Right.
I would expect no less, right? But I think we've learned that we have to do what we think is best for kids and that sometimes it's the adults who make the barriers. And so right now I feel like the things we're doing is trying to remove barriers so that we can be adaptable, we can be flexible, we can be nimble. And I think for big organizations, sometimes steeped in that tradition of what was, I keep saying to our people as we're trying to develop this, we have to provide the optimal experience for kids today, right? But it's not based on what we had yesterday. I think of my son is going to go off to college, maybe, and I feel a little sad because it won't be the traditional experience that I had. That doesn't mean he's not excited. It's a new opportunity for him. It might actually be better than I had. Who knows? Kids might be closer to one another in the dorms and have to be more creative with activities, et cetera. So I think it's always looking for the good and having gratitude that we happen to live in a community that was outstanding during this time.
Thank you so much. That's all we have time for today on Route 51. I'm Shereen Seward. I'd like to thank our guests today, Mark Wettig and Christine Gilmore. Our producer today is Joy Ratch-Kramer. Our executive producer is Rick Ryer. Rick is also our on-air producer today. Thanks to John Altenberg for the Route 51 theme. You can hear the archive of today's program at wpr.org/route51. Next week, we'll host a special encore presentation of Route 51 with three local musicians discussing the Ken Burns Country Music documentary and performing a few songs of their own. Until then, we're heading out of town.